Yeah, it should be right on there, so.
Thanks.
Sorry.
It should work.
Oh, it's from that one.
I can just do this.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, thanks very much. So I'm going to be talking today about the role of law in supporting the use of sexual and reproductive force as standard practice in dairy farming throughout Canada and the United States, which I'm going to occasionally shorthand as North America for these purposes. So first of all, I'm going to offer a brief overview of the lives of North American dairy cattle. We've heard a little bit about this already. With a focus on the ways that physical force defines animal sociality, reproduction, and sexuality on contemporary farms. I'm then going to turn to the question of how we can understand the role of law in these contemporary practices. And in particular, I'm going to describe the basic legal regimes governing the treatment of farmed animals in Canada and the United States, and the standard story about those regimes, which is that the oppressive treatment of farmed animals is essentially a problem of not enough law protecting those animals. And finally, I'm going to trouble this orthodox account of the lack of law as the primary way of understanding the role of sexual force on farms, and instead suggest that this account fails to describe the many ways that law and public policy, in fact, operate to shape the apparently private choices that dairy farmers are making. So with that in mind, I'm going to begin by sharing some information about the lives of dairy cattle in contemporary North American farms. So I'm going to start by talking a little bit about cows as social and reproductive animals, and then I'm going to go on to talk about the conditions of modern dairy farming. So I think it's important to offer a little detour into the question of what cows are like, just because despite the fact that we live in a context where dairy products are extremely pervasive, very few of us know many cows, and there are some pretty pernicious stereotypes out there about them. So this is just a sort of snapshot of some of the scientific evidence that we have about animals, the social and emotional lives of these animals. But briefly put, cows seek out and benefit from social and emotional contact. They experience emotional contagion or empathy. So if a cow with one affective state is around another cow that is experiencing joy or distress, they will absorb the experiences of others. They have best friends, they care for, they spend their time with if given the opportunity. They play less with each other if they have been socially isolated or if they're in physical pain. Mother cows are extremely defensive of their calves. So in one experiment where the experimenter brought a vehicle in proximity of a cow who's with her calf, in a kind of stunning 99% of cases, the mother cow will physically move herself into the path of the perceived threat. They're distressed by separation from their calves. They're happy when they reunite, and they express this physically. And calves that are raised by their mothers are actually more curious, sociable, and relaxed when they grow up, as opposed to cows that are raised in isolation, the way that the majority of dairy cattle are. So with this in mind, I'm going to offer a brief overview of the lives of dairy cattle in industrial settings in North America. And what I'm going to describe here isn't the case for every single cow that is raised for dairy in North America, but it is the vast majority of cows raised in North America. So calves are separated from their mothers within hours of birth. And there is, in my view, pretty heartbreaking literature in the dairy sciences about what the exact timing of this separation should be, because they want to reduce some of the physiological responses to that stress of separation, because physical injuries from the cows and calves trying to reunite or refusing to eat following the separation are the source of economic loss that the industry has to contend with. The calves are then raised in hutches. This is to allow for close monitoring of each calf's food intake and defecation, and to stop the spread of germs, because if they were allowed to play with each other, the germs would spread more easily amongst them. After a short period in group housing, dairy cows are moved into their adult housing, and for about 70% of North American dairy cows, this means a tie stall barn. So as you can see here, each cow is enclosed, chained at the neck, food in front, trough in the back for collection of waste. There's an electric trainer, I don't know if you can see this in the picture, it's depicted here, that hangs overhead for the purposes of ensuring that the cows don't defecate outside the trough and back, so that the stalls can be kept tidy without having to remove the cows for cleaning. So physically restrained in this way, cows don't have any meaningful choice over who to spend their time with, and few opportunities for meaningful social interaction. And while in some kinds of farming systems the cows are sometimes let out to pasture, it's increasingly common to see what are referred to as zero-graze operations, where they are in fact not let out of these conditions for any significant time. And so they don't have a lot of opportunity to interact socially with each other. The unfortunately heteronormatively named bullying behavior, which is actually kind of an important part of the social lives of dairy cattle if you've ever spent time in a herd, is not something that they even have the opportunity to engage in when they're tied in this way. So the only sexual contact that these cows experience, for the most part, is being artificially inseminated by human hands, generally for the first time at 13 months of age. The gist of the process is that the cow is restrained so that a person can use one hand to reach into the rectum to tilt the cow's cervix, while the other hand is used to inject a straw of bull semen into the vagina. So bull semen is its own booming industry. The semen of particular bulls are branded and advertised as delivering particular qualities in their offspring. So for example, the Robot Ready breed promises to breed calves that will grow up to be cows with teats that are particularly well placed for robotic milking. So bull semen, we've learned a little bit about this extraction process already. It's extracted by human handlers who sexually stimulate the bulls using what are called artificial vaginas. They use sometimes dummy cows or castrated steers that are manipulated to behave like a cow in estrus. And alternatively, and I think this responds to the question about the sort of grand production involved with the semen extraction, there is an alternative method of electro-ejaculation, which bypasses a bunch of that, but it's actually still less common. So the marketing materials for the bull semen industry frequently rely on tropes of human sexuality in a decidedly conservative and cisgendered mode. So the male bulls are given these very grand names like G.W. Atwood and Governor Java, while the female cows are generally pluralized and referred to simply as the daughters of the named bulls. And they're sexualized as well. For example, described as having, quote, youthful mammary systems that catch the eye, and, quote, great rear udders and attractive rumps. So both of these quotes come from bull semen marketing materials that Catherine Gillespie has uncovered in her work on the dairy industry in the American Pacific Northwest. And Gillespie also describes this t-shirt logo, which is advertising universal semen sales. So in Gillespie's description, the logo depicts a cartoon bull, quote, Sammy Semen in the foreground, sauntering up behind two smiling cows, large udders, bright red lipstick, prominent backsides angled at Sammy. The cows look happy and excited that Sammy is about to pay them a visit. The company slogan frames this cartoon scene, we stand behind every cow we service, close quote. So this slogan references both the colloquial idiom of servicing as performing a sexual act for the pleasure of the person being serviced, or in this case, cow, being serviced, and the literal standing behind a cow, which is the posture of human beings who are performing artificial inseminations. So we're invited here, as Gillespie points out, to view the sexual reproduction at the heart of industrial dairying as natural, in keeping with familiar gender tropes, and as a source of pleasure and connection for all of the parties involved. So the fact that the entire process relies on human sexual control over and even direct sexual contact with the animals involved becomes sort of a punchline or glossed over. In any case, we're definitely invited to imagine that the cows welcome and enjoy the sexual process of being artificially inseminated by human beings. So this, of course, echoes broader but much less sexually explicit depictions of dairy cattle in advertisements for milk itself, which tend to cast cows as girlish and happy and relaxed in their reproductive duties. So in a story that's familiar to feminists and critical theorists, these cows are cast as simply doing what comes naturally to them in a way that happens to benefit those who have power over their lives. So returning now to the realities of modern farming, once the impregnated cow gives birth, her calf is again separated and the process begins anew for that calf. With the calf removed, the cows lactate and are milked, usually in North America with robotic milking machines. When the fat content and volume starts to drop, the cows put through a couple of months dry period, after which time they are inseminated again. After about 3 lactations, the cow is considered to be the end of her productive life and is sent to slaughter, often at around age 4. If the cow is not slaughtered, her life expectancy would be 15 to 20 years. So in summary, we're talking about a system of absolute birth to death control of these animals, involving physical restraint, sexual use, reproductive control, restricted opportunities for kinship, representational erasure, which embraces, first of all, the increasing practices of housing cows indoors where you can't even see them, and also the representations of cows as being these sort of girlish, happy, relaxed animals. And finally, death, which I always feel the need to mention given the number of people who say to me that they're curious about my choice to focus on dairy, when that is seen as sort of a kinder animal product because they don't have to kill the cow. And they might not have to, but they do. And so this is part of the story as well. So how do we understand the role of law in this state of affairs? So I'm going to begin by offering a brief snapshot of the legal regimes governing the treatment of dairy cattle in Canada and the United States. Then I'm going to link that picture to the common implication in the animal law literature that this violence should be viewed as private or an instance of not enough law. And then I'm going to suggest that, in fact, law has affirmatively worked to support the development of these practices rather than just neutrally allowing them to emerge and failing to intervene to stop them. So in Canada, the legal regime governing animal welfare effectively exempts farmed animals from its protection in the case of animal agricultural practices. So at the provincial level, there are laws establishing standards of care and preventing cruelty to animals, but they generally include an explicit statutory exemption for common agricultural practices. Similarly, at the federal level, there's a criminal prohibition of causing unnecessary pain and suffering to animals, but the courts have construed the word unnecessary to exclude basically anything that happens in the course of farming. So it comes to mean something more like gratuitous or uncommon, more so than what we might think unnecessary looks to mean. Canada also has a series of codes of practice that offer sort of specific recommendations for each industry, including in the dairy industry. But despite the use of the word requirement in the context of these codes of practices, the codes are entirely voluntary. And the process by which the codes are developed are led by the commodity producers themselves. So the overarching theme here is that common agricultural practices are insulated from review or legal censure. In the United States, the legal regime governing animal welfare similarly insulates common agricultural practices from legal protection. So first of all, at the federal level, there are no protections for animals while they are living on farms. So the Animal Welfare Act, which is the piece of legislation that most commonly covers and protects animals in commercial settings, explicitly does not cover farmed animals, and in fact excludes farmed animals from the definition of animal to be used throughout the act. There are some protections that govern animals during transport and slaughter, but again, these are limited to transport and slaughter, and on the farm, there are no federal protections that apply. So there are, again, state criminal laws that protect animals against cruelty, but they, across the board, have either explicit exceptions for farmed animals, or the courts have implicitly created exceptions using the similar sort of trick that we've talked about in the context of the definition of unnecessary. And the exclusion as a matter of explicit statutory instruction is more and more common. There are also a handful of states that have enacted particular restrictions on specific kinds of animal treatment. So there are 11 states in the United States that have sort of specific rules governing the treatment of particular animals. And in the case of dairying, this takes the form of 3 states that have banned the practice of tail docking, which is essentially the amputation of the tail so that it doesn't get in the farmer's way and cause infection for the cows. But the bottom line is that here in the United States, as in Canada, common agricultural practices are generally exempted. practices that would be illegal as cruel in other contexts are permissible without further inquiry as long as they are shown to be commonplace in the industry. And we've seen a hint of this also already in Greg's presentation regarding sexual activity with animals as being criminal in other contexts, but in the context of farming is 100% permissible. So this is a regime that is actually structurally designed not to address the sexual, reproductive, and kinship harms that I've emphasized in my description of the lives of dairy cattle. Not only are dairy cattle denied any legal interest in their own sexual and reproductive lives, but the governing legal regime effectively forecloses any judicial inquiry into those what those interests might be and to how those interests might be violated by sexual use and control in the service of industrial dairying. So, it's easy to see why this regime has been characterized by one that simply permits harms to be committed by private parties. So arguments that the problems of industrial dairying are rooted in this lack of law include concerns that the legislative process is captured, that in fact industry is too involved in the setting of these rules, that there are inadequate or imprecise requirements, that the code in Canada is not binding, and that there's just a lack of concern to enforce these laws. So the most common complaint from animal advocates in both jurisdictions is that harmful practices routinely occur on farms and at the hands of private persons and the state does not intervene. And this failure to intervene isn't just a matter of legal practice, but it's a matter of legal jurisdiction. So the farm, in short, is seen as a space where animals suffer because there is not enough law there to protect their interests. So as David Wolfson and Marianne Sullivan have said, farmed animals are made to disappear from the law. So I want to suggest that far from making animals disappear from the law has actually affirmatively promoted a particular view of animals as objects to be used and reproduced through systems of complete control, mm-hmm. including and perhaps especially through sexual and reproductive force. So the most obvious and widely theorized of the background legal conditions that enable the sexual and reproductive domination of dairy cattle is the classification of animals as property under the law. Relatedly, Dinesh Vadaval has suggested that selective limits and allowances of human violence against animals amounts to something like a delegation of sovereignty by the state to individuals, humans over animals. But other property relations are also in play here, including the basic property rights that farmers have on the farms and the physical spaces where these animals are enclosed. So this includes the right to exclude people who might seek to enter to document or otherwise disrupt those practices. And in the United States in particular, these property rights are bolstered by so-called ag gag laws, which have been enacted in a number of jurisdictions, which create harsh penalties for whistleblowers who take photographs or videos of conditions on those farms. And finally, the market for dairy products is highly regulated and supported by North American governments in Canada through our system of supply management and in the United States through an elaborate system of price supports and subsidies. So in both jurisdictions, these marketing schemes are intertwined with promotion of dairy products through dietary guidelines, which arguably give an outsized role to dairy. And a broader political and cultural environment which views dairy products as being necessary to human health and a natural component of the human diet. So both schemes governing markets and milk products in different ways demand a certain economic value per cow that seems to require this level of efficiency that would be really hard to achieve absent widespread sexual domination and control of these animals by farmers. And even at the granular level, the state affirmatively endorses the sexual and reproductive control of animals. So in Canada, for example, the government maintains legal definitions and official databases to track and regulate the sale of bull semen. This effectively endorses and materially supports the system of precision artificial insemination. And in both countries, federal funding and resources are routinely devoted to improving farmed animal genetics, which of course also translates into controlling animal sex and reproduction. So taken together, this broader legal picture reveals that the reproductive, physical, sexual, and social domination of animals is not something that law has just neutrally allowed to emerge and failed to stop. Instead, legal regimes in both Canada and the United States have actively promoted the intensification of dairy farming and have also actively promoted a specific set of relations with dairy cattle that it's practically required that they be sexually used and reproduced through systems of physical force and complete control. So looked at in this light, we can begin to see that the private space of the farm is thoroughly constructed by law, and that the sexual, reproductive, and kinship dominance imposed on cows is not simply allowed, but is affirmatively supported by legal forms that are undeniably public in character. This is a context where public and private forms of violence are intertwined and in many cases virtually indistinguishable, which is something that feminist critics of the public to private divide have been telling us for many years in other contexts. In feminist theory, this troubling of the public-private divide has been most prominent in the context of delineating the family as a space that's legally defined as private. And feminists have really worked to demonstrate that background legal conditions in fact promote a quite particular vision of the practices and power relations that characterize this supposedly private space of the family, and that sexual access and control over women as a group is an important part of that public agenda. And so here we see an interesting structural parallel. The definition of the farm as this family-like lawless space, which on closer inspection is in fact thoroughly defined by a broader legal context supportive of a particular set of sexual and reproductive relations. And interestingly, this structural parallel is mirrored by a common rhetorical trope that you see in the dairy industry, which is the claim that it's unnecessary to have legal protections for farmed animals because farmers view their cattle as being like family. So this work of exposing the public dimensions of the private family has been a long-term and collective project that remains underway. And the sketch I offer here is just the beginning of an effort to illustrate the public dimensions of the private farm, a space similarly defined by privacy, in this case primarily through the legal mechanism of private property, which on closer inspection in many ways is defined by public legal regimes that are pursuing particular relational outcomes, including the sexual and reproductive domination of cows. So I'll leave it at that, and I look forward to your questions. Thank you.
Thanks, Greg. Do you want to come back in?
Sure. Yeah.